91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with a quick update on federal income tax preparation. Of course, the filing date is but 2 weeks away. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We'll chat with enrolled agent and accounting firm president Dr. Stephen Weil, a Fort Lauderdale-based firm, RMS Accounting. He'll have information about any changes or peculiarity to this year's filing or last year's taxes and more. Linda Gassenheimer with info about the upcoming Museum of Discovery and Sciences Wine, Spirits, and Culinary Celebration in Fort Lauderdale. One of the participants is Gino Paparello, known for his Gino's Italian Market and bakery delights. Do you know how to choose the best Parmesan cheese? You will. Stay tuned. First, the news. And it is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today we talk about everyone's favorite topic, federal income taxes. Yes, it's that time again, of course. If you haven't filed, there's just 2 weeks before the April 15th deadline.
So we'll learn the basics from enrolled agent and accountant, Dr. Stephen Weil. He's a principal with his wife, Teresa, and president of RMS Accounting. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Busy time of year.
Yes.
Well, you know, it gets busy all year long, but it's a little bit more nuts now.
I had never heard the term enrolled agent before this program. So if you would, before we get into the meat,
sure.
Explain what an enrolled agent is.
We are part of a select group that is enrolled practice before the Internal Revenue Service. What that means is we went through a very comprehensive exam given by the IRS under the supervision of the Secretary of the Treasury. They then do a background check to make sure that we're moral enough to represent people in front of the U.S. government, and we can represent taxpayers all the way through all the appeals divisions and all of the audit divisions of the IRS, as well as prepare taxes. We are the only true tax professionals where our designation is about tax. There are three groups of people that can represent people in front of the IRS. That would be CPAs, who get their license from the state and may or may not be tax specialists, enrolled agents, and attorneys that are admitted before the bar who may or may not be tax specialists. But
now,
we go back to the Civil War.
If you're doing my return as an enrolled agent, that doesn't mean that you're working for the IRS.
No, absolutely.
It's not like I'm filing with an agent.
No, it's not like you're filing with a revenue agent. But it does mean that we've met the standards set forth and passed a very detailed tax exam, as well as met the background check. But we work for our clients, not the government.
And it also means, as you explained, that you'll represent your clients should they be audited at no extra charge.
That is correct. Our office, our policy is if we prepare a return for you and the return is audited, we represent you at no additional charge to make sure that the return is represented as prepared. You, of course, have to have the receipts and documents.
So the ultimately, the taxpayer is always liable, but
the taxpayer is always responsible for their return, regardless of who prepares it. You know, you don't just get to point, and they're certainly responsible for any additional tax. In our case, if we prepare a return and any penalties are assessed, we would always pay the penalties for the taxpayer, assuming that we had been given all the information.
Now, these 2 days, do more people use tax service, or do more of them go online and solo?
There's a lot less people when you look at in total. The people with complex tax problems use a tax professional. A lot of the millennials that are working for a living and maybe have a W-2 and might even have a home with some mortgage interest are turning to their computer can do everything, their iPhone can do everything, and they're turning to the online services or the computer. The good news about that is it is fairly simple. It is very inexpensive, and you can do it 24/7 whenever you want. The bad news about that is that you're not really sure how secure some of those services are with your data, and if they're doing it for free, what are they doing with your data so that they can actually raise money to pay for it? And the other thing that comes along is the iPhone computer, when you get a tax audit notice or when you have a question about what should you do to reduce your taxes in the future, is not going to be much help.
Let me ask you, though, when you say that because it's free, mm-hmm. they may do something with the data, you're talking about like data mining, they
Correct.
May sell it?
Well, they may be mining it, Nave. They may not be selling your name, or they may be using your name, but they don't stand under the same privacy restrictions that professional preparers, people subject to Circular 230 of the IRS, do. They're a software provider. So read very carefully the disclosures in there. You will be surprised.
You mean
what
the things
you
just check agree
yeah,
to?
Yeah, everybody checks the box. If you read it, you may be surprised with what they're responsible for, what they're not, and what rights they have.
And of course, it would take you a week to read it.
Yes, and a magnifying glass.
Tell me, what are some of the indicators that someone's trying to steal your identity or information or money by your filing income taxes?
Well, that comes from a lot of places, not only filing income taxes. We have seen identity theft and fraudulent tax returns filed based on information provided to doctor's offices, hospitals, school boards, and it could be a tax preparer that's using your information. So there's a lot of places it can come from. You need to be careful with who you give that information to. And if you go to do an electronic filing and the government says, wait, we already have your return and you know you didn't file it, that's an indication of you have a tax problem. But remember, that's not the only problem you can have in today's world. It could be a fraudulent tax return was filed in your name. It could be a loan application.
That's common,
or credit
though.
Cards.
Right.
Absolutely. So keeping your information close and not sharing with everybody is more important than ever.
Is it better to file? I'm sorry. Better to file early to prevent someone from filing underneath you?
It helps to file early so that a fraudulent return isn't filed before you get in. Certainly does help if you think that's a problem, but it's more important to file accurately. So in a lot of cases, early has become more difficult. People with brokerage accounts, they get a brokerage statement that says, here's your interest, your dividends, and then 4 weeks later they get one that says, here's a corrected one.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
sometimes you get one that says, here's a corrected one.
Right. Let me ask you this. How do we know that if we do go to a professional tax preparer and we don't do it, you know, online ourselves, that they don't use the data or that they have means of protecting it?
Well, you need to ask them about that. What do they do to protect the data? How long have you been in business? How are your people in your office screened? Most people don't ask enough questions. And in many cases, they don't ask the right questions. You know, if you go to somebody you were referred to that somebody's been dealing with for a long time, right. that may give you some assurances.
Many of these firms take on part-time help at the peak of tax season, so they may not really know the background of some of these
part-timers. Well, that is possible, and as I say, that's one of the things you should ask about. We have a policy in our firm that we run a criminal background check on everybody we hire. We run a credit check on everybody we hire to see what their position is.
Make sure
is
that
in.
No one has a lot of gambling debts
well,
or something.
Well, we don't want them to be in such a position that they would be dealing with people's identity and people's numbers and people's investment account information that, you know, they might be desperate for money.
Right.
And so that's one of the things we're looking at. And, you know, we keep that up to date on our staff.
I read that one of the complications this year is this gig or sharing economy income, people who are using Airbnb and Uber, that are Uber drivers and stuff. Will you explain that?
Well, if you're using Uber, or if you're an Uber driver, that's self-employment income. So you have income to report, you have auto expenses to report, you have other expenses. You're going to be filing a Schedule C. You're going to be subject to self-employment tax, and a lot of people are not aware of that. If you're renting short-term through Airbnb, that's really not a rental activity. That's a business activity.
If you're renting out your...
You're renting out your apartment, your
right,
home, whatever.
Right.
And you also need to be aware, if you're doing that, of your sales tax obligations, as well as zoning obligations in your area.
Or if you're an Uber driver, is your car insurance deductible?
Well, typically you could take all of your auto expenses based on the percentage of business use of your car, or you could take the standard mileage rate. So you're going to have to figure it out two ways in many cases. Am I better off with the actual expenses, or am I better off with the standard mileage rate? You don't get all of your car in either case. You get the business use. Also important that you keep a mileage log so that you can show to the IRS how many miles were business, what was personal.
On this Airbnb, you said something about zoning. What if, because I know a lot of people are doing it where they're not supposed to, and it's not zoned for it.
As far as the IRS is concerned, it's still income and it's still taxable. As far as the sales tax people are concerned, it's subject to sales tax. They're short-term rentals. It's subject to the hotel bed tax in most places.
Wow.
So, but then you have to file a tax return. What were your expenses? What percentage of the time was your property used for these activities? What percentage was it available? How much time was it used personally? So it becomes a lot more complex, especially if you're doing this for the first time.
Could you touch on, for low-income filers, to be wary of instant refunds?
Well, one of the things I see as I drive down the street and at other places are, you know, have two kids, head of household, we'll file a return and get you $3,000 back. And the answer is what they're advertising is the earned income credit. And very often, one of the areas of fraud that's happening is somebody goes in to somebody, tax preparer that's opened up and is here for the 3 months, and they say, gee, I want that $3,000 you had on the sign. And they say, did you earn any money? Well, no, I didn't earn any money. Well, how about if we make up some income? We'll pretend that you were self-employed or you were selling things, and we'll just put enough income on your return to get you that earned income credit. That is fraud, my friends. You can't just make up income. People understand that you can't make up deductions and you can't not report income, but making up income so that you can get credits you wouldn't otherwise be allowed is also a fraud.
We're speaking about taxes with Dr. Stephen Weil.
I'm almost on overload here.
He's an enrolled agent and president of RMS Accounting, a 30-year-old accounting firm based in Fort Lauderdale. A short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Stephen Weil. He's a principal with his wife, Teresa, and president of RMS Accounting. And we're talking about filing your 2015 tax returns. Stephen Weil, does the Affordable Care Act have any effect on tax preparation?
It's had a tremendous effect. First of all, a lot of people are confused by all those new forms they're getting, the 1095B, 1095A, 1095C, that lists whether or not they had insurance and when they did. And, of course, we have people that thought they were getting refunds that are finding that they're not because of the Affordable Care Act penalty. On the other side of that are people that went to the Affordable Care Act website and applied and put in income and then made more money than they thought they were going to make, and are now finding that the credits that they got to reduce their insurance costs, they have to pay back to the government because of the amount they earned. So you got a credit all year long, and now all of a sudden you find yourself having to pay back $3,000 in credits because you earned $100 too much over the limit. And those of us in the tax industry, we get to tell people this cheerful news.
So you think you're doing something good by now getting health insurance, and now you're saying if you make $100 over?
Well, if you make over 400% of the poverty rate, you have to pay back 100% of your credit. So, for example, if I was making 385%, my boss said, here's a $4,000 raise, and that now puts me at 400%. Instead of paying back a portion of it, which is limited, I now have to pay back everything I got. I might have to pay back, in effect, more than the end of the year bonus was.
It should just be that extra percentage, wouldn't you think?
Your right to any of the credit phases out entirely at 400% of the federal poverty rate. So it becomes very complex figuring out how much do I have to give anything back? How much do I have to give back? If I didn't have coverage, do I owe a penalty? How much is my penalty? Who's a member of my household? I've got my two children. They're a member of my household. Well, now I have to also make sure that I can prove that I had health insurance for them.
You know, when we were talking about the person whom a lower income person who makes $12,000 goes into the tax preparer, what about that $3,000 credit? Tax preparer says, did you make anything? Well, let's say you made this much money so I can get you back that $3,000 credit. In that case, well, two questions. Number one, isn't the tax preparer also liable here?
Well, certainly. And the IRS does go after, you know, if one of the hints for people is that your tax preparer should always be signing your return and putting their P10 number on it. That is an identification number for the IRS. If they refuse to sign your return, that's a problem. And the tax preparer can be responsible. In fact, you want to stay away from tax preparers that do this because when the IRS gets them in their sights, they don't just look at the tax preparer. They look at all the returns that person has prepared to see whether or not, you know, they were making up, they told all the people that they could take this deduction or they were making up deductions. And if they're making up deductions for you and they're making up deductions for others, chances are you're going to be in the sights of the IRS when they are.
And my second question is, if you make an honest mistake, you're audited. You make an honest mistake versus intentional fraud. Is there any difference?
An audit is not the end of the world. And many audits are correspondence only. I forgot to include this dividend from a bank I forgot about or something. And you're going to pay a little bit of interest. You may pay a small penalty, but it's not the end of the world. You know, if you didn't commit fraud and you made a mistake, you took a deduction you shouldn't have taken, you didn't have the records to back something up that you thought you had, or you lost those records between the time of the tax return and the audit, it's not the end of the world. You will have some tax you may owe. You might have a small penalty and some interest, but you're not going off to jail. Don't start shaking because you get a letter. I have so many people that come into my office holding an envelope from the IRS, and they're afraid to death to open the envelope. And you open the envelope, and it says, "Hi, we're afraid you had identity theft last year. Here's a PIN number so you can avoid that this year." Or, we got your return, and it's just taking us a little longer to process it. Although some letters from the IRS are bad news, they're not all bad news, and you can't know that until you actually open the envelope.
Stephen, in your long career, I'm sure you've seen people go to extreme lengths to claim deductions. What are some of the strangest ones you've encountered?
Well, we've had people look at everything from, gee, I have a dog at my place of business, and that's my security system, so I want the dog and the vet and everything that goes along with the dog. And if you're not in the dog training business or the dog guard business, probably not going to fly.
Or maybe you own a junkyard.
You own a junkyard, it might, if the dog lives at the junkyard. In many cases, what's deductible for one person may not be for another. Years ago, I had a client that was in the salvage business, and their prior accountant had told them they would rent a boat and rent a plane when a large wreck sunk. And their prior accountant told them that, hey, you're renting a plane. That's luxury travel. That's not deductible. You're renting a boat in Belize or wherever these countries were. That's luxury. That's not travel. You can't deduct that. Well, the answer was they were in the salvage business. And when a ship sinks somewhere, you don't get to look around for a flight. And renting a plane to get to someplace in the middle of nowhere and renting a boat to go out and look at a job that you could decide that you might make $4 or $5 million on, or you might decide it's not the job for you and walk away from because you're going to be liable if you take it, that's deductible for him. Where if you or I rented a private jet because we decided that we have to do a seminar in California, that would not be deductible
for
us.
How about if I hire a private jet as a business expense, supposedly, to take four of my buddies to the Super Bowl?
Well, unfortunately, that's not deductible. We can only deduct the amount that regular airfare would cost us to take those four buddies. And that assumes...
You say that's unfortunate?
That's unfortunate. And that assumes that the four buddies are going to have a business relationship to you and that somewhere along the way you're going to discuss business. And enact
business.
Well, that's
business. Easy enough.
Yeah.
I know it's only 2 weeks till filing date is, you know, till the deadline. But is there anything you can tell our listeners that they can still do if they haven't filed and take advantage of anything in these last 2 weeks?
There are things that you can do. We always tell people the best time to look for the tax breaks is before the end of the year, not after. But if you're not in a pension plan and haven't made an IRA contribution, a great way to put away some money for yourself and have the government fund part of it. If you're in a 25% tax bracket, in effect, you're going to be putting in 25% of the government's money. So that's one way to look at it. You can go through your receipts. People overlook stuff all the time. We conduct a tax interview with every client, and there's hundreds of questions on the interview, and I get to people that I've seen for years, and I'll say something like, oh, you're a teacher. Did you have classroom expenses? Because those are an above-the-line deduction. They came back this year. And they'll go, oh, yeah, I buy pens and pencils for the kids, and I buy all these other, I buy prizes. Well, $250 of that goes right on the front of your tax return. The rest of it goes on Schedule A, if you can file Schedule A as an itemized deduction. So there are always things that you can look at, and the key is, if you're hiring a tax professional and you're just sending in a bunch of paper and they're sending you back a bunch of paper, I put it to you, you're wasting your money. You need to sit down with that person and talk with them, because if you know everything you're supposed to put in the envelope and they know everything about you, then you don't need to get together. But that generally is not the case. Many times I'll sit down with a client and I'll say, what's new? And they'll tell me nothing is new. And then you'll be going through and you say, well, you have another child you're paying daycare on. Oh, yeah, I had a baby this year. Well, you told me nothing was new. Well, the baby came in May, and, you know, so nothing's new anymore. It's May again.
Right. How about if for low-income people, where they can get to have volunteers who are knowledgeable tax people prepare their taxes for free?
If you're a low-income person and you want to take advantage of one of the VISTA volunteers, they are. They have to go through a class with the IRS. Not a bad way to go.
Both Broward and Miami-Dade have those representatives.
Have VISTA programs that where they're certified by theirs. So it's not a bad way to go, where you don't have to pay and you're going to get a return. And if you don't have anything else or aren't going to need to talk to somebody in the future, certainly those are viable services, especially for the elderly. All too often we find people asking about getting returns, going to places and somebody charging them to do a return, and you look and they don't need a return. You know, they're below the income filing threshold.
Anything in particular that's different on this year's 1040 from past years?
This year it's what's different that's the same, because we had a bunch of stuff that expired last year that Congress saw fit to put back into the tax code and bring back, but they didn't do it until December. So we were all ready for these things to be gone, and they came back as of December. So you'll see a lot of things that you saw last year that you thought were going to be gone.
What about these seminars you do? Tell us.
Our belief has always been that the more educated people are, the better they can do. We work hard to help our clients accomplish more. So we do a number of seminars at our office. Once a month we do a seminar. Next one is coming up on the 20th of April, and that's surviving an IRS audit, because people always are more scared than they maybe should be of audits. On 5/18, we have a seminar, Money, Your Children and Your Grandchildren. We have to include the grandchildren, because in many cases, you know, the grandparents have more money to put away for the grandchildren than parents do of young children.
What are the laws on gifting right now?
If you gave a gift of $14,000 or more during the year, you need to file a gift tax return. Now, that doesn't mean you have to pay gift tax. It just uses up part of your lifetime credit, which is approximately $5,200,000 and change.
Oh, I'm almost
so
there.
If it's under the $14,000, no gift tax return. A husband and wife can make a joint election to put together a gift of $28,000. And if you paid directly for somebody's tuition or medical care to either the college or the provider, that does not count as a gift.
And last question, how long do we have to keep our records? I keep hearing all different number of years.
Well, it depends on what records. So the answer is, if you bought stocks or you have assets, you need to keep the records at least 3 years from the date you file the return on which you sell them. However, other receipts, such as tax receipts, those type of things, 3 years from the date you filed the return or paid the tax. Tax returns you should keep forever. And the reason for that is because the statute of limitations on a tax return runs from the date you file the return. And if the IRS comes to you 5 years from now and says, you never filed that 2005 tax return, okay, how do you prove you filed it? Well, there's good news on this front, though. And the good news is you can image all that stuff, put it on a USB drive or a CD and keep your records that way.
Okay, just learned how many mistakes we've made. Dr. Stephen Weil is an enrolled agent and president of RMS Accounting, Royal Management Services Accounting. It's a 30-year-old accounting firm based in Fort Lauderdale. Thank you very much for enlightening us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Food and Dining up next.
Welcome back to today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. And coming up soon in Broward, it's the Museum of Discovery and Science's Wine, Spirits, and Culinary Celebration. It's been going strong for 20 years now. And chef, author, syndicated columnist, and our friend Linda Gassenheimer is going to tell us all about that and more. Hi, Linda.
And more. Hi.
Especially the more.
Yes, we've got a lot of more here, right here in the studio. So, all right, so looking for really good Parmesan cheese, or how about some olive oil? And we've got plenty of that right here in the studio. There's been recent scandals about these Italian ingredients. So, you know, how do we know what we're buying, and is it authentic? So our guest is going to give us some answers. He's Gino Paparella. Yes, he's the owner of Gino's Italian Market in Hollywood, Florida. So, well, welcome, Gino.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me today. It's a great pleasure to be here.
It's our pleasure with what you've brought.
Well, you know, you can't just talk about food. You actually have to taste it. So, you know, you have to bring it, you have to taste it, and you have to see what we're all talking about. So that's what I did.
Sure did. Well, thank you. And also, of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions for our expert or maybe some comments about Italian ingredients? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743, excuse me, WLRN.
Or radio at WLRN.org.
And of course, we have our favorite wine guy with us, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that you can read in the Miami Herald or online. You can also read Fred's column, his wine column. It's on Saturdays in the Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, you're talking about Italian food, so I'm going to talk about, wait for it, Italian wine.
And I'll bet there's some bubbly there.
Yeah, actually there is.
Oh, well.
Surprise, surprise.
Okay. All right, Gino Paparella, our question, Parmesan cheese. So a few weeks ago, a study found that there was cellulose, non-Parmesan cheeses, and grated Parmesan cheese that we were buying. So how can we be sure we're buying the real thing?
Well, the way to be 100% sure is to buy the whole piece of Parmesan and have them grate it for you at the store that you're purchasing from, and most stores will be able to do that for you. Or you have a little table grater at home and grate it as you need it. In my opinion, that's the best way to do it.
Right, but how? Now, if you're going to do that, even some Parmesan cheese that comes in a chunk isn't really the best Parmesan cheese. What do we look for?
Well, I'm partial. So the best Parmesan cheese, in my opinion, that you can buy is either Grana Padano or Parmigiano Reggiano.
Now, what's the difference between Grana Padano and Parmigiano Reggiano?
The Grana is a younger cheese. It's not aged as long. It's more in the 9 month area.
Mm-hmm. Now, what does we have here?
This one here is Parmigiano Reggiano.
Right.
We buy. I buy from my store to sell something that's in the area between 18 and 24 months of age. Normally, right. It goes. If I remember correctly, it's 12 to 24 months is the base one.
Then it's 3 years is really the one to look
they
for.
They call it Stravecchio, which means very old,
which
is at 36 months, and
that is
going to be and you'll know the difference even from the price that you're going to pay for it. But once you've eaten a chunk of that, you'll never want to eat
anything. Now,
what
else?
What does the sample sell for? By the pound, say.
This averages like $17 a pound, $17 to $19 a pound, so it's very reasonable.
Well, we all just we had to dig into this.
It's actually sweet a little.
Yes.
It's so good.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And what I like to do is, you know, a lot of times I'll go home and I'll have a piece in the refrigerator and I'll take it out of the refrigerator and cut into it and say, oh my God, why? So what I have figured out is you need to let it, take it out of the wrapper and let it sit on the counter for a good half an hour, bring it to a little bit of room temperature. Mm-hmm. That way it takes away from the flavor of the wrap, and that way you bring out the flavors of the cheese.
It's easier to grate too.
Yes, and it's easier to grate.
Okay. Well, now let's go on to olive oil.
Okay.
Okay. Scandal on 60 Minutes, the report mentioned that much of the imported olive oil isn't pure olive oil. According to the study, it's made with inferior oils from other countries, or it may not even have any olive oil in it at all. So what should we look for? And I've got three bottles here of olive oil, and we've got a bowl with some bread to taste it. So
don't mind if I do.
Yeah, right. Now, here's a bottle of olive oil, and it's only $4.29 for a, well, it's an 8-ounce bottle, mm-hmm. Okay? So how do I know? I mean, what's in this?
Well, if you look at the back of the label, hopefully it'll say produced and packed in Italy.
It does. It says packed in Italy.
Okay.
Under license.
Under license. So right. So it's got to be packed in Italy. But it'll also, now if it's a blend from different countries, it'll tell you.
It's got a number on it, and it contains oil from Spain, Greece, and Italy. But that doesn't mean it's bad. It means no. You're still using olives.
No, they're still using olives. And it has, now, as you go to the better olive oils, and sometimes regionally, the olive oils will take on different characteristics. If you go, some olive oils, let's say from Sicily, you buy olives that are made from the Castelvetrano olive. You buy olive oil that's made from the Castelvetrano olive. It's got sometimes it'll have a little bit of a burn at the end,
a peppery.
A little peppery, mm-hmm. And some of them are now in the Abruzzi. You'll have beautiful olive oils that are very smooth in flavor, and now the better extra virgin olive oils will also say on the back of the bottle their acidity. The lower the acidity level, the smoother the olive oil.
So what would be a number that would be low?
A 0.1%.
Now you say, you know, olive oil from Sicily, but it won't say on the label that it's where the olives actually come from, or does it?
The better olive oils will tell you where they come from.
Absolutely. Now you have one, I'm reaching over here for it, and that's what we're eating here, and it's Gino, you have your own organic, it's got your label on it.
Yes, that's from
Tuscany.
And it's
organic, and this is from Tuscany.
Yes.
So, and it says so on the bottle.
Yes.
So I guess the thing to do is you have to really read the labels.
You do. You have to really read the labels.
And it's not just the price, because you can pay a lot of money for something that isn't what you think it is.
That's correct.
Now, is this too good to make, to cook with or to saute in? Or?
They say that olive oil burns at a lower temperature, so it'll burn quicker when you're cooking with it. But for salads and my wife steams broccoli and takes extra virgin olive oil and pours it over the top after the broccoli is steamed, and that is absolutely delicious.
Right. Some people say that they have a cheaper olive oil when they're going to be sauteing, mm-hmm. and then save the good olive oil for putting on cooked vegetables or over your salad or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Dipping.
Or dipping.
And for dipping, yes, absolutely.
Just a second on the Parmesan cheese. Does that have to be refrigerated, by the way?
It should be.
Okay.
Unless you buy a chunk and you say, okay, you know, I'm going to use it later on this evening, then no. But if you're going to keep it for a few days, I would suggest to keep it in the refrigerator.
Right. Now, let's get back to this mozzarella that's here.
All right.
and the event that you're going to be in, which is April 8th at the Museum of Science.
Yeah, it's already here.
Discovery and Science. Yes, it's almost here. So you've got mozzarella. Tell us about this mozzarella.
Well, we make our own fresh homemade mozzarella. This is from whole milk curd. Now, the big thing is buffalo milk mozzarella.
Right.
And that is made from buffalo milk. But normally you'll find that, and a lot of that is imported in from Italy. I don't know of any place that you can buy buffalo milk here in the States to make or to have the curd or to make the milk to make the curd.
Is it pasteurized?
Yes. This one is. This is a whole milk curd. This is.
So when you say whole milk,
cow's
curd,
milk.
So you're going to be demonstrating at the event how to make this,
yes.
correct?
Yes.
And this is like your third year that you've been doing
this? This is our third
it?
Year. We were fortunate enough a couple of years ago to be invited to participate, and we wanted to do something different because there are so many restaurants that do so many different things, and no one does fresh mozzarella, and we decided to do the fresh mozzarella, and it was very well received. People kept coming back again and again.
So if
how
you want
long
to go
does it take to make mozzarella?
Fresh mozzarella, it'll take a good from start to finish with curd that's already there, about 25 to 30 minutes.
So
that fast, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but how do you make the curd?
The curd is made from milk, but we buy curd that's already that,
so you have to buy out. The curd. Mm-hmm. So where do you buy that?
Local distributors have curd.
And you mix it with the milk.
Mix it with the milk, and you mix it with hot water and hot milk. Because what you do is the first thing you do is you break down the curd, you cut it, you break it down into little pieces, and you add hot boiling water, and then you kind of work the hot water into the curd itself by melding it together. So now it's all those pieces have started to become one, and now you've got to start to stretch it. Now because you've added cold curd to boiling hot milk or boiling water, you need to add to dump out that water and add more boiling water to continue the stretch.
Now, is this cheese made to be melted in dishes also?
Yes.
Or topped with pizza?
Yes. To get regular, this is the best cheese to do over pizza or over.
So this is better than what I get on Domino's.
now, Joe.
On that note, I think we need to take a break here.
There's a notable difference.
Yes.
And if you want to see that, him making that, Gina making this mozzarella, it'll be at the Bank of America Wine and Spirits Culinary Celebration, Fort Lauderdale Museum of Discovery and Science on Friday, April 8th. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking with Gino from Gino's Italian Market. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Gino Paparella. He's the owner of Gino's Italian Market in Hollywood, Florida, and he's been giving us some really great tips on what to look for when we're buying Parmesan cheese and olive oil and other Italian ingredients, mozzarella, for sure. He's going to be demonstrating how to make his homemade mozzarella at the Bank of America Wine, Spirits, and Culinary Celebration at the Fort Lauderdale Museum of Discovery and Science. That's Friday, April 8th. And you want more information or to buy your tickets, you go to modsevents.org. So now it's dinner in minutes time. Okay, so guess what? It's got to have Parmesan cheese in it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
It's quick and easy chicken Parmesan. So I take boneless chicken breasts, and I cook them in a spicy tomato sauce, and then I top it with a grated Parmesan cheese.
How do you cook them?
Very easy. How do I cook them? Well, I saute them in a skillet, and just for a minute, I put some flour on it, then I saute them, and I put the spicy tomato sauce.
Not breadcrumbs.
Nope. Spicy tomato sauce in it. Now, I use low-sodium marinara sauce, because then I can add the salt that I want. But you could use any kind of pasta sauce you want.
You always like to be in control.
I'm not going to go there, right? We're not going to go there.
That was quite a non sequitur.
No, I didn't mean anything by that.
Okay, let's go back to chicken Parmesan.
Let's
How's
go back
that
to, yeah. Do you grate your own Parmesan, Linda?
Of course.
Okay.
I don't want cellulose in my Parmesan.
Okay.
So I grate my own, Parmigiano Reggiano. And so the chicken will cook in the sauce, and then you take it out and you put grate some Parmesan on top. That's easy. Mm-hmm. So the side dish is I cook some linguine, I drain it, put some olive oil on it, really good olive oil. I've read the label. And then some fresh basil, salt, and pepper, and that's it. Joe, this is a 10-minute dish. You can do it.
10 minutes?
Yeah. Well, for you it's 15.
Yeah.
Okay, and this dinner's not going to break your calorie bank. It's from my book, Quick and Easy
Chicken.
How
thin do you pound the chicken breast?
I don't pound it.
You don't?
No. I have it nice and juicy.
Okay.
So the complete recipe. Joe, the complete recipe. You can learn all about it.
Dinnerinminutes.com.
Absolutely. With a photograph. And please follow me on Twitter. That's @LGassenheimer. Fred, I think we all need a drink right now.
I know I do. So, Italian wines. Italy is one of my favorite wine countries, in part because it's so varied. I think every region has its own wine grape, its own wine, and many of them are really great. So let's hop on Italy's nationwide Autostrada Highway and travel the country from north to south to sample some of these wines.
Sounds good to me.
You ready to go?
I'm ready.
We start in Piedmont in the foothills of the Alps near the international fashion city of Milano. And then we go out in the countryside to the tiny town of Barolo, population only 600 people. And this is the home of the wine called Barolo. It's made from the grape called Nebbiolo. And this is the big, red, bold wine, a great wine for beef roast, leg of lamb, roast goose, and sharp cheeses and that sort of thing. So write it down, B-A-R-O-L-O.
I can see this might be your favorite one.
That's one of the favorites, I'll tell you. It's powerful stuff.
Okay, you told us to
write it down.
He's
a little aged sometimes.
Okay.
Now we turn east to the tourist town of Venice, which is home of the Venice Film Festival. And you'll find film producers here wooing the world's starlets for the roles in their next movies with that region's most fun wine, which is called Prosecco.
And it's bubbly.
And it's bubbly. But yes. It's bubbly, but it's softer and gentler than champagne. The bubbles are under less pressure, so it doesn't zing your mouth quite as much. Now, Prosecco isn't the name of the grape. That's Glera, G-L-E-R-A. But Prosecco is the name of the little town where it's made. And this is popular with 20-something drinkers because it's trendy and, even better, it's cheap. Now, let's head southwest to the two old Italian city-states, Siena and Florence. They fought it out a dozen times in the Dark Ages, but today this is much more friendly Tuscany, the home of Chianti. And this, obviously, is Italy's most famous wine, made from the Sangiovese grape. It's a little lighter in body and crisp with acid, so it goes well with tomato-based dishes like pizza. And I think pizza and Chianti is the menu for every modern late-night study session in college dormitories. Now, you go farther south and take a ferry ride out across the water, and you get to the island of Sicily. And this is where you saw the Corleone family helping the harvest in the Godfather movies. Now, Sicily was a wine backwater for a long time, but today it has some of Italy's most cutting-edge wineries. People are really putting money into it now. And the wine to drink there is the sturdy red wine called Nero d'Avola, N-E-R-O-D-A-V-O-L-A. And Sicilians serve it with oxtail soup, and Americans like it with hamburger and meatloaf.
Of course.
Why and not? So what else?
All right.
And so the sun sets as we bid adieu to our quickie tour of the wines of Italy.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Mm-hmm. And
thanks, Fred.
Yeah, throughout your whole tour here, Gino had a big smile on his face. How did that sound, Gino?
Oh, that sounded fantastic.
Fred, what foods go best with the Prosecco?
Well, you can. It's like champagne, I guess, in that you can have almost anything with it. Wow. It doesn't matter what it is. It's great for just sipping all by itself. You can have it with seafood. I guess you wouldn't have it with a big steak, but any kind of vegetables, I sort of think. It's very, very varied.
Okay. Well, that sounds wonderful. Well, Gino's Italian market, I was amazed by it. It's a little bit like stepping back in time when markets were local and they were family run. You're the second generation running your market.
That's correct, yes.
So how do you remain successful against all these national chains?
Well, we stick with the basics. We give great products, we give fair pricing, and we give great service. People come in and they need something, they know that they can ask for me to pick out their steak. They can ask for me to pick out their piece of Parmigiano Reggiano or cut an extra larger chunk or help them choose their wine.
So you sell wine as well?
Yes, we do wines as well.
Now, can you eat there other than the bakery? I mean,
we have tables where you can, you know, grab a sandwich, but we don't have an actual restaurant to where we do, you know, food prep in the back. We do full staff catering, but that's off-site catering.
I see.
Yeah. So now you mentioned meat because it's hard to find really good meat. Where do you source your meat?
Well, we get everything out from the Midwest. Everything comes in from And it's
so
all,
direct. Yes. You get it direct. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's all choice and prime beef. And we stick, again, like I said, we stick with just the finest quality of beef. We have a line of beef that we handle exclusively here in South Florida. It's called Certified Piedmontese. And it's an all-natural, hormone-free, antibiotic-free beef. And you know, we have various cuts from New York strips to ribeyes to flank steaks and skirt steaks and even the ground beef.
When you talked about here in Florida, do you only have the one market?
Yes, only the one market.
So you better give out the address because everybody's going to want to run there.
Well, we just celebrated our 42nd year in South Florida, as a matter of fact. We are we are in the present location for the last 30 of those years. We're at 5729 Johnson Street in Hollywood. Just 2.5 blocks east of 441, right on Johnson. We invite you to come out and visit us.
And say you heard it on radio.
Yes.
Ask for Gino.
Yes, absolutely.
You also do something I think is wonderful that you mentioned to me, that every Sunday, no matter what, you have a big Sunday meal with all the family, the grandchildren, everyone.
Absolutely, and we are not allowed to miss.
Grandma
Mama,
rules.
Yes, absolutely. Grandma does rule. And it's something that we all look forward to. I mean, even though I may talk to my brother and sister a couple of times during the week, it's the actual time that we actually get to sit down and see each other. Now, the nice part of it is my sister has 3 children. I have 2. And my brother who was recently married, has got an 18-month-old and another baby on the way. So that makes for
a nice quiet evening.
It makes a nice quiet evening. But I tell you what, you forget how great it is to have the little ones running around. They just bring everything to life.
So all of you are involved with the market, the whole family?
No, it's just myself and my father and my son that run the market.
So now there's a third generation going to be there, which is wonderful. Well, on that note, it's been really wonderful talking, very delicious. thank you, Gina Paparella.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
For the delicious cheese that you brought with us. You can join him at the Wine, Spirits, and Food event at the Fort Lauderdale Museum of Discovery and Science. That's April 8th. For more information, you can go to modsevents.org. Fred Tasker, thanks for your great advice and for your tour.
Always a pleasure.
Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman.
Be fun to go to Italy with Fred.
Yeah, boy. Fred and Gina. Oh, why we all go. Joe. Yes, I think that sounds great. Next week, we're going to be learning about the new advances in diabetes management from the Diabetes Research Institute at the University of Miami. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our lead producer, Richard Ive. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. As always, you can easily find free audio archives of our programs at the website wlrn.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like if you will. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, it's the Public Radio Classic Program Science Friday with host Ira Flato. And of course, Bonnie and I return Monday for a topical currents devoted to regional environmental impacts of new energy initiatives. Learn more at 1 o'clock only on Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gastenheimer, Fred Tasker, thank you. Here and now, next from NPR News.